All right, let's go to Zechariah chapter 12. Last three chapters, we're dealing with a number of events concerning Armageddon. And not all of Armageddon stages are within this book, so we're going to start with a survey of the whole Armageddon campaign. And then we'll look at these passages and see where Zechariah makes his contributions. Where did it get started? Doing what? Oh, no, I have no overheads for this next one. These were from the previous session. Okay, what I want to do is give you the maps and then the localities where these separate eight stages will occur. We cannot look at all the passages because we're focusing on Zechariah, and so I'll give them to you verbally. You can look at your own leisure. We're just going to just focus later on those sections which Zechariah is making a contribution. In general, of course, the Middle East is involved. Next. And of course, the state of Israel will be particularly involved in this campaign, but the Bible gives us several other specifics. Next. One important place we mentioned previously in Zechariah will be the city of Babylon in what is now Iraq. And this is to become both the economic and political capital of the Antichrist during the second half of the tribulation. This will play a key role during the campaign of Armageddon. Next. Also very important is the valley, the northern part of Israel, the southern part of the Galilee. Christians have come to call this valley the Valley of Armageddon. The Bible itself never gives the valley that name. The term Armageddon is a combination of two Hebrew words meaning the mountain of Megiddo. It refers to a mount at the west end of the valley upon which the city of Megiddo was built. The biblical name for the valley is the Valley of Jezreel. So in your Bibles, when you come to the term Valley of Jezreel, that's what Christians have come to call Armageddon. They'll play a role in the overall campaign, though not they're all often assigned to it. Next. Also involved is the capital of Israel, Jerusalem. Next. And more specifically includes the Old City, the Mount of Olives, and then the Valley of Jehoshaphat that separates the Old City from the Mount of Olives. Next. The most important places we'll see in this campaign will be the city of Bozra, that's its Hebrew name, but known today by the Greek name as Petra. Bozra and Petra are the same place, one is Hebrew, one is Greek. I'll explain the differences of name a bit later. We shall see this will be the most important single place in this entire campaign. Next. Now, the first stage of these eight stages is called the assembling of the allies of the Antichrist. The assembling of the allies of the Antichrist. Biblical passages, if you're taking notes, are Revelation chapter 16, verses 12 through 16. Revelation 16, verses 12 through 16. Joel chapter 3, verses 11, 9 through 11. Joel chapter 3, 9 through 11. And also Psalm 2, the second Psalm. Antichrist will take his own city, his own army out of Babylon and come into northern Israel. Next. From different parts of the world, he will go into this valley. And next, from different parts of the world, his allied armies will come together. These are the other seven kings that have been under his authority since the midpoint of the tribulation. And so the valley will play a staging area for the campaign. It'll play a similar role that England played here during the last stages of the Second World War when the allied forces gathered together in Britain, but the actual final campaign began on the beaches of Normandy in France. Now, England was to World War II as well, the Armageddon would be in this final conflict, the place where armies gather, but the conflict would begin elsewhere. Next. We'll take several views of Armageddon. I'm standing on Armageddon itself, Mount Megiddo. The northern end of the valley is marked by the hills of Nazareth, where the city of Nazareth was standing. And that's the northern border. Next. Now, the eastern border is marked by two things, Mount Tabor, which is the dome-shaped mount, and then the hill of Moreh, which is the pointy top mountain. That's the eastern border. Next. Here's a close-up of part of the eastern border. Mount Tabor has become the traditional Catholic site of the Transfiguration. You might recall that when Jesus was transfigured, Peter suggested he be allowed to build three tabernacles, one for Moses, one for Jesus, one for Elijah. Well, Peter was not allowed to build those three tabernacles, but he did not have to worry. The Catholic Church has proceeded to build all three tabernacles for Peter. Originally, they were all three separate buildings, but only in the 20th century, they united in this one large church now standing on top of the mount. And if you go inside the church, you can see the remains of the three ancient tabernacles. The problem is they picked the wrong mountain. The transfiguration occurred when he was at Mount Hermon, about 45 miles northeast of Mount Tabor, so they missed this one by 45 miles. But they've done worse. Next, along with Tabor over here at the Hill of Moreh, marks the eastern border. The Hill of Moreh serves as a twofold witness of God's power of resurrection, because here on the southern slopes is the town of Shunem. That's where Elisha raised the woman's son back to life. On the northern slopes of the town of Nain, which is where Jesus raised the woman's son back to life, it serves as a twofold witness of God's power of resurrection. Next. The southern border is also marked by two things, Mount Gilboa and the hills of Samaria. We're looking southeast. Here's the hill of Moreh, the eastern border. Here's a section of Gilboa, the southern border. Next. Here's a close-up view of part of the Mount Gilboa range. Mount Gilboa is where Saul and his three sons were killed by the Philistines that then set the stage for the establishment of the kingdom of David. Next. And along with this, the hills of Samaria here, the hill of Mount Gilboa marks the southern boundary. All these shots were taken from the west side of the valley from Armageddon. Next. Now we cross the valley to the eastern side. I'm standing on Mount Tabor. Here you see the northern border, which is the hills of Nazareth. Here in the distance is Mount Carmel, and Mount Carmel marks the western border of the Jezreel Valley. Next. Here's a section of Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is where Elijah had his contest with the prophets of Baal. When he lost the contest, the prophets were taken to the River Kishon, which is what you see here. It was slaughtered by this river. And the river flows closer to the mountain, so somewhere along here is where slaughter would have occurred. Next. This is what the Bible means by Armageddon. This is Mount Megiddo right here. And that's where the Antichrist will meet with allied forces, though the armies will be, of course, separated in the valley below. Okay, next. The second stage will be the destruction of Babylon. The details are found in Isaiah chapters 13 and 14. Isaiah 13 and 14, Jeremiah chapters 50 and 51, Jeremiah 50, 51, Revelation 18. And while the Antichrist is meeting his forces here in Israel, his enemies come together while he's gone and his army's out of the city to quickly destroy the city. Now, in Isaiah chapter 13, verse 3, Isaiah 13, 3, the ones destroying Babylon are called God's consecrated ones. These are the believing Gentiles of this period that will not follow the party line and that use this opportunity to destroy the city. And the king, Jeremiah shows the king is outside the city when these events occur. And so the city is just put to the flame and destroyed. Not only at this point, what I would have is a series of pictures for you that shows where Babylon has been rebuilt to become the capital of the Antichrist, then be destroyed in the second stage. We can see by the bottom that the area of Babylon is in the area of modern-day Iraq. Arab country of Iraq does not like 5 foot, 4 inch Jewish kids running around the country taking pictures of it. So for that reason, I don't happen to have those pictures for you just yet. But after the next Arab-Israeli war, I might get those for you. Okay, next. The third stage will be the attack and fall of Jerusalem. Attack and fall of Jerusalem, this will come up in Zechariah. We'll deal with those shortly. There's two main ways to get to Jerusalem. One is the easier but longer coastal route. Yet there's a shorter but more treacherous central mountain route. The Bible does not specify which way he will come. We know that he will come because of the prophecies, but which way he comes we're not told. He may take one way or the other. He may do what Sennacherib does in Isaiah chapter 10. After gathering his armies up here in Armageddon in Jezreel, he split his army in half, sending half one way, half the other. Regardless of how they get there, they do get there. And after some heavy bit of fighting, Jerusalem finally falls into the Gentile hands. And then one passage you can mark down where the fighting is described is Micah chapter 4, verse 9. Micah 4, 9 through chapter 5, verse 1. 5:1. The Zechariah passage we'll look at shortly. Next. Here you see Jerusalem. First of all, the old city, which has been part of Israel since 1967. This is the view of the old city from the top of the Mount of Olives. Next. Mount Scopus. Here you see a more traditional view from the top of the Mount of Olives. This is the temple compound. Somewhere in this compound, the Jewish temple will be rebuilt. Between the wall of Jerusalem and where I'm standing is nothing but graves, so three different categories. Against the wall are Muslim graves. Inside the valley are Christian graves, and by Christian I mean Catholic and Greek Orthodox. And on the Mount of Olives, these are all Jewish tombs. So you have Muslim tombs here, Christian tombs here, and Jewish tombs here. But the Jewish tombs have something that the Muslim tombs don't have and the Christian tombs don't have. Inside every Jewish tomb, there is a light inside, an Israelite. Next. This is the southeast corner of the temple compound wall, always the largest, the highest point between top and bottom. One of the temptations of Jews took place on this corner. Next. Most of the wall you see today does not go back to Jesus' day. Most of it goes back to the Turks, who rebuilt the wall after the year 1517 AD. Next. The temple compound area from the Garden of Gethsemane. Next. You see the rooftops of the old city. And this is Mount Scopus, and here's the Mount of Olives. Next. You have the holiest site in Judaism today. Normally it would be the temple because there's no temple standing. This is what the holiest site is because this is called the Western Wall among the Jewish people and Wailing Wall among Gentiles. But the largest stones from about here all the way down is about 20 more levels below the ground. These are the remains of the Western compound wall of the temple compound. It's not the walls of the temple building itself. It's the walls of the Western compound, the wall. And because that's what's left of the second temple, destroyed in the year AD 70, this has become the holiest site in Judaism. Next. Now on the top of the temple compound, this is the Dome of the Rock that stands over the summit of Mount Moriah. So if you were able to go inside, they now forbid non-Muslims to go in there. You will see the top of Mount Moriah. And the view of most historians and archaeologists, that's where the Holy of Holies of the Second Temple once stood. There's a minority view that the temple stood actually over here, about 330 feet, 100 meters north of the temple compound. That's the minority view. Neither one can prove the view without digging on top of the compound, and because of Muslim control, they cannot dig on the compound. So that is still an unsettled question. Next. Now we'll go on to a new city, which has been part of Israel since 1948. Next. It's a well-kept city comprised of very modern apartment houses, as you see here, but it's always a mixture of the old and the new. Here in the valley, you see a monastery built in the 6th century AD. It's called the Monastery of the Cross. And why is it the Monastery of the Cross? Because 6 centuries after the fact, it was built on the exact site where the true grove grew from which the cross of Jesus was made. If you believe that one, they'll tell you another one. Next. Much of the city is comprised mostly of apartments, which you do not rent, but you purchase. Next. Very expensive place to live today. To get a decent apartment will cost you easily about three-quarters up to $1 million. Next. But live one of these high-rises cost you over $2 million to get into one of those. Next. This is the seat of the two chief rabbis of Israel, functions a bit like a Jewish Vatican. And this is the key chief synagogue of Jerusalem. Every Jewish city had many synagogues and one chief synagogue. That just happens to be the chief synagogue of the city. Next. This is the Knesset, the Israeli parliament building. This is where the government meets and debates and makes its decisions. Next. Now, for the most part, as we've been indicating already, the Jewish people at this point of time, for the most part, are not in the land anymore, not in the city anymore. There's still some Jews there, as we shall see. But the majority that survive the destruction of the tribulation go to the city of Bozrah Petra. That is the city of refuge. You'll find this in Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, Micah 2, 12 and 13. And because the goal is to annihilate the Jewish people in this point of time to avoid the second coming, that will bring on the next stage. Next. Well, that's before we do the next stage. Here's several pictures of the area. Now, for it to be the proper locality, it must meet three requirements. Number one, it must be in desert territory according to Revelation chapter 12, verse 6. Chapter 12, verse 6. Secondly, it must be a mountainous area. In Matthew chapter 24, verse 16, Matthew 24, 16. And finally, it must also be in a pre-existing place in the same passage. Well, sad to study here. Look at the surrounding territory. You can see it's desert territory, once called the wilderness, the land of Edom. Next. Now, here we're still south of the city. You can see it's inside these mountain ranges. In the Bible, this was known as Mount Seir. It's within those mountains the city happens to be located. Next. And this is a pre-existing place. The only way in and out is to a narrow passageway, a wadi or a gorge that begins here. You have to go for about a mile and a half, about 2 kilometers, before you get to the other end. And this says that the further in you go, it gets narrower and higher. Next. Notice how narrow it has become and the walls have gotten higher. Next. You can see horses and people below. That gives you a sense of proportion. Next. The only way in out of the city is through this narrow passageway or gorge. Next. We're almost into the city. Next. And now inside the city, looking back at the narrow passageway. Now, two different civilizations inhabited the city. First were the Nabataeans, followed by the Romans, and both left the remains here. Even if you never had any archaeology, you can simply tell by looking which are Nabataean and which are Roman. Romans built like everyone else built back then, rock upon rock, stone upon stone. The Nabataeans did not like to do it that way. They go to the edge of a cliff like here and here and simply chisel out one big building from it. Next, here's one example. This whole building is one piece of stone. You see the Arab man sitting at the foot of the steps. Notice how small he is compared to the structure as a whole. And these pillars were never freestanding pillars. They were simply chiseled out away from the side of the cliff. That's why the Greeks called the city Petra. Petra in Greek means a cliff rock, and the city was carved out with buildings made carved out from the cliff rocks, from Petra. Next. Once you're inside the area, it opens up in a large circular area, which explains the Hebrew name of Bozrah. Next. The term Bozrah means sheepfold. Ancient sheep for narrow passageway going in, so the shepherd could count his sheep and goats. Next. Once you're inside the passageway, there was more room to maneuver. The city shaped like a giant Bozrah, a giant sheepfold, a narrow passageway going in, and a wide circular area, freedom to maneuver. Next. There's plenty of ground for growing food, lots of water. but nobody lives there today. It's waiting to become a Jewish neighborhood. Next. Here we'll be confronted with these walls with carved out buildings. Next. Here's your Nabataean version of a condominium. Next. The large buildings were for the upper classes. The poor people had to live in this tenement housing, but these two notices are carved out from the sides of the cliff. Next. Here you go, you'll be seeing these large buildings carved out of the side of the cliff. Next. Again, this whole building is one piece of rock. See a small person sitting in the doorway. Well, gives a sense of proportion how big these buildings are. Next. This comprised of soft sandstone, sometimes multicolored, as you see here. Next. Otherwise totally surrounded by these cliffs. Next. Here's the main street during this Roman administration. Next. You can tell it by the stone upon stone, the pillars that line the street. Next. This was the main gate to the street wall and the stone upon stone. Next. While the street itself is Roman, it dead ends the Nabataean large building remains right straight ahead. Next. Roman amphitheater, this will comfortably seat 3,000 people. I can almost visualize the Jewish leaders congregating here to find out what they must do to escape these things and finally realize they must come to faith in the Messiahship of Jesus. Next. This was the Roman temple administration building during some military occupation. Now again, the purpose of this campaign is to annihilate the Jewish remnant of that day. Next. This brings on the fourth stage. In the fourth stage, the armies come down from Jerusalem all the way down to the city of Petra Basra. This is found in Jeremiah 49, verses 13 and 14. Jeremiah 49, verses 13 and 14. Now, at this point is when Israel finally realizes what they need to do. They'll finally realize that they have rejected the true Messiah, and he won't come back until they accept him. That's the prerequisite to the second coming. So as they begin to repent, they'll issue a call for repentance. Not a call is issued, but a decree. Found in Hosea chapter 6, verses 1 through 3. Hosea 6, verses 1 through 3. When that decree is issued, that will trigger the last 3 days of the tribulation. For the first 2 days, they'll confess the national sin of rejecting him, using the words of Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. Isaiah 53, verses 1 through 9. On the third day, the whole nation will come to faith. As we saw in Zechariah chapter 3, verse 9, God will remove the iniquity of the land in one day. Isaiah chapter 66, verse 8 told us they'll be born in one day. Romans 11, verse 26, all this will be saved. When the whole nation comes to faith, then the third day, they will then plead for the Messiah to return. The words of pleading are found in Isaiah chapter 64, Isaiah 64, Psalm 79 and Psalm 80, Psalm 79 and Psalm 80, which in turn will then trigger the second coming of the Messiah. Next, here's your sixth stage. The fifth stage is with national salvation. The sixth stage will be the second coming. The initial place of the second coming will be the city of Basra Petra. You'll see this in Isaiah chapter 34, verses 1 through 7. Isaiah 34, 1 through 7, Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6, Habakkuk 3, 3, Habakkuk 3, 3, and Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13, Micah chapter 2, verse 12 and 13. This will bring on the seventh stage next. And the fighting between Jesus and the army of the Antichrist begins here at Petra. Work its way back towards Jerusalem. Next. Finally conclude in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And this is found in Joel chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. Joel chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. Next. The Valley of Jehoshaphat separates the old city here and the Mount of Olives over here. Starts out rather white and a lush green, but as you keep moving through the valley, it gets narrower and drier. Next, you'll see how lush it is initially. Next, that's the section where you have the Christian graves I mentioned earlier. Next, it finally dries up. All you see is the trees that were planted by the Israeli authorities a little while ago. Next, it finally narrows down to all there is the winding paved road. It finally empties into the Dead Sea. Now, according to Revelation chapter 14, verses 17 through 20, by the time they're fighting against the level of the blood reached up to the level of a horse's neck. Now, people try to visualize this in Jezreel, which is a bit difficult, but notice where the Bible puts it is in this valley, very narrow, may not be that difficult to visualize. Next. The last stage, the victory will be his victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. This is in Zechariah, which we'll talk about in a few moments. And with this ascent to the Mount of Olives, both Armageddon and the tribulation will come to a close. Next. What's called the Mount of Olives is really three separate mounts, with the central mount here being the most dominant. But it's also somewhat cluttered with different churches. Sadly, there was not a whole lot Jesus could do as somebody come along later and building a church over the spot. So this church marks the place where disciples were left in the Garden of Gethsemane. They even have a spot over here just off the map. They build a little marker where Judas kissed Jesus. This church marks the place where Jesus prayed in Gethsemane. Now, they're the official names for these churches, and I made up my own names for many of these churches. This church is a Russian Orthodox church. It's called, the official name is the Church of Mary Magdalene. My name is, I call the Church of the Onion Heads for obvious reasons. And this chapel here marks where Jesus wept over Jerusalem. Next. This large church on the top of the Mount of Olives is called the Church of the Ascension, also Russian Orthodox. It marks the exact spot from where Jesus supposedly ascended into heaven. If you go in there, you'll see a slab of stone they show you with two footprints embedded into it. Because when Jesus blasted off, he burned these footprints into this rock. Did better here than he did with the Transfiguration Church. They missed it only by a mile and a half. Because Luke says when he ascended, it was by the town of Bethany in the lower eastern slopes of the Mount of Olives, not on the summit. So they missed this one only by about a mile and a half, but still the wrong spot. Next, here again is the Church of Onion Heads. They even built a church over the spot where the rooster crowed when Peter denied Jesus. It's, if you move towards our direction from this church, you will see that church. The official name of that church is the Church of Peter Gallicunta. I call it the Church of the Cock-a-doodle-doo. Next. And here's the Mount of Olives from the top of the Temple Mount. When I take the groups in my study tours of Israel, as we just did before coming to England, when we get to the Sea of Galilee, I always thank the Lord the Sea of Galilee was too big to build a church over, because if they could have, they would have. Next. Okay, here's a summary of all eight stages. Stage number one, the Antichrist meets his armies in Jezreel. Stage two, destruction of Babylon. Stage three, the attack and fall of Jerusalem. Stage four, the armies come down to Petra. Stage five, Israel's national salvation. Stage six, the second coming. Stage seven, the fighting goes back towards the valley of Jehoshaphat, ending there. So that'd be stage seven. And stage eight would be the victory ascent up upon the Mount of Olives. So he said, this is the overall picture. Now we'll deal with some of the details that Zechariah deals with. We should be on page four of your outlines. We now come to the second burden of the Word of Jehovah, comprising chapters 12 through 14. To summarize this, we have here the detailed description of the final campaign against Israel. In the course of this campaign, however, Israel will be purged, saved, and redeemed from its enemies. The Messiah will return and establish the Messianic Kingdom. It provides some more details as to how the events of chapters 9 through 11 will finally be fulfilled. Now, calculate the campaign of Armageddon in chapter 12, verses 1 through 9. The focus here is on the physical deliverance of Israel. Verse 1 introduced us now to the second burden within the book, but now the message concerns Israel in particular, the burden of the word Jehovah concerning Israel. And now the burden is focused specifically, the oracle on Israel. He begins with pointing out the God who controls these events at the end of verse 1. Thus says Jehovah, who stretches forth the heavens, he controls outer space, who lays the foundation of the earth, he controls the physical earth, who forms the spirit of man within him, he controls human life. This is the one who controls everything from as far as we can see down to ourselves. And because of who God is and what he can do, everything he says he will indeed someday come to pass because he controls human affairs in every case. Then in verse 2 and 3 describes the nations against Jerusalem. And he begins by describing in verse 2 Jerusalem as being a cup of reeling, meaning getting drunk or getting alcoholized. Behold, I make Jerusalem a cup of reeling unto all the peoples round about. The picture is that Jerusalem becomes a vast bowl of alcohol. And nations gather together and drink, and they drink and finally get so drunk they're merely reeling. Now, the word cup is used symbolically. It's often a symbol of divine judgment, as in Psalm 75, verse 8, Psalm 75, verse 8, Isaiah chapter 5, verses 17 through 23, Isaiah 5, verses 17 through 23, Jeremiah chapter 25, verses 15 and 16, Jeremiah 25, 15 and 16, Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 7, 51, 7. And upon Judah also being the siege against Jerusalem, when Jerusalem is besieged, even Judah will feel it. But notice there's a separation between Judah and Jerusalem, because we're about to see Judah is now found elsewhere. But not only is Jerusalem a cup of reeling, in verse 3 it's also become a burdensome stone. It shall come to pass that I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the peoples round about. And all those who burden themselves with it shall be sore wounded or sorely lacerated. And the picture is, it's a large stone with very jagged edges. And someone tries to pick up this heavy stone and is able to lift it up so high, but then it's just too heavy and it falls in between his hands, but also lacerates the hands as it falls. So those who try to finally destroy the city in this violent campaign will simply be lacerated by it. Then it gets more specific. All the nations of the earth shall be gathered together against it. A point he'll repeat shortly in Zechariah 14, verse 1 and 2. Zechariah 14, verses 1 and 2. So all the armies of all nations now come against the Jewish people for one last event, one last conflict, one last attempt to annihilate the Jews once and for all. Now let's raise the question, why is he so anxious to destroy the Jews once and for all? And that lies in the understanding of the precondition to the second coming. Here's one of the key differences between the rapture of the church and the second coming of the Messiah. The rapture of the church has no preconditions whatsoever. It can happen any moment of time between right now and the signing of the covenant. The actual second coming does have one key precondition, which is Israel's national salvation. Until the Jewish people believe on him and request for his return, there'll be no second coming. This is something Satan knows rather well. He also knows that once Jesus comes back, his cure is over. He also knows there will be no second coming until Jewish people ask him to return. So if he can succeed in destroying the Jews once and for all, before they have a chance for Messiah to return, there'll be no second coming, and Satan's cure is eternally safe. And that's why he's always had this war against the Jewish people. That's why things like the Crusades occurred, that's why the Russian pogroms occurred, that's why the Nazi Holocaust occurred. As Revelation 12 also says, that once Satan is in the tribulation, he knows his time is short, and knowing it, he exercises all of his satanic energies to try to destroy the Jews once and for all. We'll see in chapter 13 that in the course of the tribulation judgments, he does destroy two-thirds by the time Armageddon occurs, but one-third is left. And the purpose of this campaign is to try to wipe out the one-third remnants, the living, the closing days of the tribulation. So now in verses 4 through 9, he will deal with the physical deliverance of Judah and Jerusalem, begin with a judgment upon the horses in verse 4. The timing is in that day. What day? In that time when all the armies, all nations come together in that prophetic future. There'll be a judgment. I will smite every horse with terror, his rider with madness. I will smite every host of peoples with blindness. Result is they will rush to their own destruction. And what he promised will happen to Jews once in Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 28. Deuteronomy 28, 28, he now promises upon the Gentiles. He says, I'll open mine eyes upon the house of Judah. And while the enemy is blinded, God's eyes are not blinded, and he watches over the people of Judah. Notice again, Judah is being distinguished from Jerusalem. In verses 5 and 6, he will energize the Jewish forces. The chieftains of Judah in verse 5 shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem are my strength, in Jehovah of hosts their God. Their God is Jerusalem's God. And again, Judah and Jerusalem is distinguished by the fact when they hear about the war of Jerusalem, it will begin to energize the Jewish forces. And in verse 6, you see the energizing. In that day, the day of the war, I'll make the chieftains of Judah like a pan of fire among the wood, like a flaming torch among the sheaves. As a result, they'll begin to burn and burn and burn against the enemy on the right hand, left hand. So that eventually Jerusalem will be restored and no longer attacked. Judah and Jerusalem are again distinguished in some degree. Judah is helping rescue Jerusalem. But now look at verse 7. It's important to see the chronology of how God will save the Jewish people. Verse 7 says, Jehovah shall also save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David, the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem, will not be magnified above Judah. And so notice, he says he will save the tents of Judah first before he rescues the people of Jerusalem. That's the chronology of God's rescuing. Also notice that the Jews living in tents, not in their permanent homes, because from the midpoint of the tribulation, the Jews have been fleeing the land and the city, and they're fleeing to the city of Bozrah Petra, and therefore now living in temporary boats, tents, and now living in permanent homes. And as we saw in the overall campaign, the God, he'll come to Bozrah before he comes to Jerusalem. He will save the Jews of Bozrah first before he rescues the Jews of Jerusalem. That's the reason for the distinction between Judah and Jerusalem in this passage. And the reason he will rescue Judah first is so that the two groups will not be magnified above Judah. The glory of the members of the house of David would not be magnified. The glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem would not be magnified. To show Jerusalem they're not more special than the rest of Judah. And again, he points out in verse 8, the energizing of the Jews of Jerusalem. The source in that day, in the day of that final conflict, the actor shall Jehovah defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So that he that is feeble, in that they will fight like David. The weak ones among the Jewish people will fight like David did. David's like among the Jews will fight like the angel of Jehovah. How strong is the angel of Jehovah? He killed 185,000 Assyrians in one night. 185,000 Assyrians were killed in one night by the angel of Jehovah in Isaiah chapter 37. Verse 36, Isaiah 37, 36. And then God renders judgment upon the armies that came together against the Jewish people. It shall come to pass in that day, the day of the final conflict, that will seek to destroy all nations that come against Jerusalem. Before that happens, must come the national salvation, regeneration of Israel. So in capital B, he now deals with the salvation and spiritual deliverance of Israel from chapter 12, verse 10 to chapter 13, verse 1. Now verse 10 shows that they'll begin to plead for him. The cause is, I will pour out the spirit of grace in supplication. Grace means it is unmerited favor. Once the grace is poured out upon them, will lead them to believe and to be saved. Supplication causing Israel to return to God. And the pouring out of the Spirit is what will lead Israel to come to national salvation. This outpouring of the Spirit upon the whole nation is also prophesied in three other places. Isaiah chapter 32, verses 13 through 20. Isaiah 32, verses 13 through 20. Isaiah 44, verses 3 through 5, Isaiah 44, verses 3 through 5, and Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32, Joel chapter 2, verses 28 through 32. And the Spirit will be poured out upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and they shall look unto me whom they have pierced. Now, the way the King James reads, they shall look upon me, but the Hebrew word does not mean upon, it means unto. And because of the mistranslation in the King James Version, people think he must come back and they see him and then they believe on him. However, once he comes back, it's too late to believe on him. And furthermore, he won't come back till the Jewish people believe on him. That's the prerequisite to the second coming. So it doesn't say, there's not the Hebrew word for upon, it's the Hebrew word for unto. They shall look unto him. And they won't look unto the one they formerly pierced, the Hebrew word that means to be thrust through, a reference to the spear that pierced his side in John chapter 19, verse 37, John 19, 37. And they will not recognize the one that was once pierced through happens to be the Messiah. They look unto the one whom they once pierced. They begin to mourn for him. They shall mourn for him as one mourns for only son, shall be in bitterness for him as one is in bitterness for his firstborn. And the mention of the only son and firstborn son shows the intensity of this mourning. Well, here the focus is on the Spirit upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem. The other passages I gave you mentions the rest of Judah as well. Makes a comparison in verse 11 with the mourning for King Josiah. King Josiah was the last good king Judah had. Once Judah died in the war against the Egyptians, there were a series of wicked kings that finally brought on the Babylonian destruction. So in that day, in that time of the battle, when they mourned for him, there'll be a great mourning in Jerusalem, and the comparison is with the mourning of Hadad Ramon, the Valley of Megiddon. It's a mourning for the death of King Josiah, detailed in 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verses 22 to 25. 2 Chronicles chapter 35, verses 22 to 25. And now we have the mourning of the royal house in verse 12. The land shall mourn every family apart. The house of David apart, the wives apart, that's the greatest members of the royal house. The house of Nathan apart, the wives apart, that's the least membership in the house of David. Nathan was a son of David, but was not the kingly line that came through Solomon. But now in later parts of Israel's history, the line of Nathan began to take preeminence over the Solomonic line because of the Jeconiah curse of Jeremiah chapter 22. Jeremiah chapter 22, verses 22 to 30. Jeremiah 22, verses 22 to 30. It'll be of the house of Nathan that the Messiah will come. And Miriam, or Mary, the mother of the Messiah, came from the line of Nathan, from David. Furthermore, there'll be the mourning of the priestly house in verse 13. They fell in the house of Levi apart, the wives apart, that's the greatest line, and then the family of the Shimeites apart, their wives apart, that's the least important line of Levi. And finally, the mourning of the people in general in verse 14. All the families that remain, every family apart and their wives apart, which will then lead to spiritual cleansing of Jerusalem in chapter 13, verse 1. The timing is in that day, in that prophetic future as part of Armageddon, there will be a fountain opened. In the Old Testament, the fountain at the tabernacle or temple was a means of cleansing from ceremonial uncleanness. But But now, with the outpouring of the Holy Spirit upon the house of David and upon the house of Jerusalem, this outpouring of the Spirit will serve as a fountain for sin and for uncleanness. For sin involves judicial guilt, which requires justification. And uncleanness requires for moral guilt, requiring sanctification. So by means of the outpouring of the Spirit, bringing them to faith, they'll finally receive the Messiah and come to national faith. And that will lead to capital C, the spiritual cleansing of the land, in chapter 13, verses 2 through 6. And in verse 2, he pronounces a judgment against all sources of pollution. Again, it shall come to pass in that day, the prophetic future in connection with Israel's salvation. There'll be rule of all idolatry. I'll call the names of the eyes out of the land. They shall no more be remembered. And secondly, rule of the false prophets. I'll cause the prophets to pass out of the land. And then demons. I will cause the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. There'll be a removal of idolatry, false prophets, and demons. But then verse 3 mentions there'll be the execution of those who are false prophets. It'll come to pass when he shall yet prophesy, still in their act of rebellion, and his father and mother shall beget him and shall say unto him, you will not live, for you speak lies in the name of Jehovah. His father's mother to beget him shall thrust him through when he prophesies. Thrust him through, the same word that was used in Hebrew in chapter 12, verse 10. Chapter 12, verse 10. And indeed, the false prophets were to be executed in Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 to 10. Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 to 10. Chapter 18, verses 20 to 22. Chapter 18, verses 20 to 22. And so in keeping the Old Testament requirement, even the parents of false prophets will be the ones to execute their sons for false prophesying. This shows a national transformation. There'll be zeal against those specific sins. And furthermore, in verses 4 through 6, it describes the hunt for false prophets. Now, verse 4 points out the false prophets will end up being ashamed because the prophecy never came to pass. It shall come to pass in that day, in conjunction with the issue of the false prophets, the prophet shall be ashamed every one of his vision when he prophesies. Shame because the prophecy did not come to pass. And one evidence of any false prophet, ancient or modern, is that the prophecies don't come to pass. Neither will they wear a hairy mantle to deceive. And there are two things that mark the false prophet. One is a hairy mantle, an imitation of the mantle worn by Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 13. 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 13. It's also what Elijah the prophet, that's also what John the Baptist wore, Matthew chapter 3, verse 4. Matthew chapter 3, verse 4. They could easily discard the hairy mantle. But the second mark of a false prophet is they tended to scar their bodies, like the prophets of Baal did. And the scars cannot be easily removed. So a false prophet is confronted in verse 5. He'll deny ever being a prophet. He says, I am no prophet, and my tear of the ground have been made abodement from my youth. So the question in verse 6, what are these wounds between your arms? The excuse he will then give, these with which I was wounded in the house of my friends. If you pull verse 6 out of the context, as some people have, you can make it a messianic prophecy, but in context, it's not talking about the Messiah, but false prophets. And furthermore, Jesus was not wounded in the house of his friends, he was wounded by his enemies. But again, in context, he's not dealing with the Messiah, he's dealing with the false prophets that began in verse 2. Because they have those scars on their hands, it'll prove to them that they are false prophets and they'll be executed anyway. All right, let me stop here to make sure and go over the time allotted on the DVD, and we'll finish up the book after the break.